From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, why the TV series doing the best job of addressing sexual harassment in Hollywood may be the one starring a cartoon horse. Then the cinematographer of A Star Is Born talks about shooting the concert scenes in the film, which sometimes involved crashing a real show.
And then there was the run and gun, sort of, we have 10 minutes to shoot in between two sets with a real audience, apologizing and thanking the audience for shooting a movie in between two bands.
And Cat Power deconstructs a song from her new album. All that coming up today on The Frame. Over the past year, almost as soon as men in Hollywood began losing their jobs over allegations of sexual misconduct, the question started popping up, how soon would they be welcomed back? The latest season of the animated series BoJack Horseman deals with the question directly. While several TV shows are touching on themes related to the Me Too movement, New York Times writer Amanda Hess argues that BoJack may be doing it best. I spoke with her today about her latest piece for the newspaper. It's titled, "The Only Hollywood Abuser I Want to Hear From is a Horse."
One thing that's become clear in this season of shows is that the idea of the very special episode is a little bit outdated. This season, Insecure actually pokes fun at that idea with a show within a show called Kevin, which is a reboot of a fake 90s family sitcom that is filled with Me Too and Time's Up and Black Lives Matter puns.
Alexa, play R. Kelly.
Can't. Canceled. Stay woke, Kevin.
Issa Rae, who created the show, actually has said that she's not interested in actually doing a Me Too episode in Insecure because she's worried about this idea of collapsing a really complex issue into, you know, a seamless and easy episode of television. So now we are seeing some other shows that are creating whole arcs and even whole seasons around ideas of harassment and abuse and accountability. One of those shows is the reboot of Charmed, which is a show about three sisters who are also witches. And in the reboot, sexual harassers are literally demons who the witches are casting spells on and trying to banish from Earth. So that is one show that has decided that harassment is a big enough issue that it can build like an entire show's premise around it, which I think is really interesting.
Another show that seems to be doing some really interesting work is BoJack Horseman. It's an animated Netflix show that you write about in some ways has been preparing for this moment since it premiered back in 2014. Why is this show so well positioned to deal with these and other issues?
BoJack is a show that has always been interested in a Hollywood abuser. BoJack Horseman is, you know, he's such a flawed character that I wouldn't even call him an anti-hero. You don't even really want for BoJack to succeed in his career because you see that every time he gets more power in Hollywood, he abuses it. And just this season, the fifth season, BoJack Horseman starts to ask a question of what accountability might look like for BoJack, or what might happen if everyone in the world found out about what BoJack does on his sets and in his personal life.
Most of these women don't even remember, I bet.
Well, that's really convenient for you.
I'm the one who has to live with this. I'm the one who has to feel the guilt all day, every day.
So you're the victim here.
Yeah, and I know that's not the woke, progressive, intersectionally appropriate thing to say, but I would say, yeah, I'm the one who has suffered the most because of the actions of BoJack Horseman.
You've suffered.
Yeah, I have.
The most?
The most.
Really?
I think it's worth noting right here that we're talking about an animated series about a talking horse, and yet what this series is doing is so true to life. I want to listen to a scene from this most recent season and a character named Vance Wagner. He's kind of a cross between the worst of Mel Gibson and the worst of Alec Baldwin. And here he's confronted by a photographer at a premiere for a Sandy Koufax biography film. And he's cast in the title role even after getting caught saying that he hates Jews.
Hey, Vance, did you get practice swinging that baseball bat from the time you hit that prostitute with a baseball bat?
What? Who told you that? I'm Tom Jumbo Grumbo, and this is Gotcha. Vance Wagner, you hit a woman with a baseball bat. What's your side of the story?
Okay, look, when that altercation occurred, I was an immature child of 38. I'm not that guy anymore. Vance Wagner respects women.
We have a tape of a voicemail you left for your 14-year-old daughter.
Oh, God.
Let's give it a listen, shall we?
I'm going to murder you. I'm going to murder my daughter. I don't respect women.
I mean, it's hilarious, and yet it's not. He then announces that he's retiring from public life, but cut to 5 years later, and he's back. So what is BoJack really drilling in on right here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is this very canny and funny way of illustrating that in Hollywood, taking time out of the spotlight is seen as, you know, akin to like serving time in prison. And I think now the public has started to push back on that idea. And I'm not sure what the next sort of framework will be for men like Vance Wagner who want to come back. But that's one question that the show is taking on this season.
And it's not just that BoJack and Charmed and Glow and Good Fight and Jessica Jones and other shows are looking into this realm. They're looking into it from a position of knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it's done well, it's kind of obvious how helpful that inside look is. So with BoJack, this season, the initial inspiration was that Raphael Bob Waksberg, who is the creator of BoJack, was really upset that CAA, which is his agency, had brought on Mel Gibson as a client. So it is sort of interesting to see the craft sort of used as a platform in that way. But TV also allows us to process a lot of the questions that have come up over the past year in fiction. So we don't have to deal with real people. We don't have to put our attention toward bad men, but we can start to think about like what we might want to do with people like that.
Amanda Hess is a critic at large at the New York Times. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the cinematographer of A Star Is Born talks about shooting all the live concert scenes. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. It's easy to talk about the music in the latest update of A Star Is Born. The new movie was co-written and directed by Bradley Cooper in his directorial debut. Cooper plays Jack, a popular but troubled musician who falls in love with the up-and-coming singer Ally, played by Lady Gaga, whose real name is Stephanie Germanotta. But one of the other stars of A Star Is Born has nothing to do with its songs. It's the film's cinematographer, Matthew Labatique. His credits include many films with Darren Aronofsky, including Black Swan and Mother, the first two Iron Man movies, and the other big release this past weekend, the Marvel movie Venom. A Star Is Born is Labatique's first real love story behind the camera, but that wasn't his only challenge. Lady Gaga insisted that she and Cooper sing live in the film, and some of their performances were shot in front of real audiences at the Stagecoach and Glastonbury festivals. I started by asking Labatique how they pulled off filming in a real concert setting.
This film was very difficult to sort of navigate the stage performances because we had three different modes. Basically, we had the Coachella mode, which is borrowing stages that were already set up with the lighting that was already existing and putting in our own crowds. And then there was the run and gun sort of, we have 10 minutes to shoot in between two sets with a real audience, apologizing and thanking the audience for shooting a movie in between two bands. And then we had the third, which was the Greek Theater, in which Shallow was performed, where we actually, in more of a movie fashion, was able to create the Greek Theater as a set and put a certain amount of crowd in. So that was my most controlled scenario. But the lighting of it had to have a consistency. My goal was that, in creating a character from a cinematography standpoint, Jackson Maine might as well be, Jack White. And I had to make sure that the audience maybe subconsciously felt like this is his lighting. You know, this is his road show. And it's also in the film, in the sort of visual movement of it, a representation of rock and roll. And I wanted that to be a signature for Jackson so that Ali had a place to exist within his world.
Tell me something, boy.
And then sort of moving towards sort of a white light or a neutral light of sobriety when she sings in the end scene. After all of her ascension, it's her rebirth into what she's meant to become, which is what Jack believed in her.
I fear myself. I'm off the deep end. Watch as I dive in. I'll never meet the ground. Crash through the surface where they can't hurt us. We're far from the shallow now.
I have a couple questions about this scene. I'm going to kind of break them apart. First is what the scene has to accomplish. It has to say something about their relationship, it has to advance the story, and it has to be incredible music. So when you're breaking down those elements of it, how do you figure out what leads the way in terms of how you're going to shoot it?
It's about putting the camera in the correct spot. And it
always
sounds
is. So basic, but most
it
people
does sound
don't
basic.
Get that.
But you know, I've often been given shot lists, or I've been asked to create shot lists. I could put together a shot list for any scene, but there's no emotion to it.
Until if everything you see is them. Planned.
Yeah. Once you see the performance and you feel the performance, people don't typically rehearse these days, but they discuss. So when they discuss, I start to think about where to put the camera. And with a director as sensitive as Bradley, he's also placing the camera. And so that scene, and the funny thing is, the first time we see the stage, we didn't do very many wide shots, and we didn't do any shots looking at the proscenium of the stage, but the closest thing to it was the wide shot that leads them onto the stage that sees all the glory of the Greek theater. And that's just putting the camera in the right place and then in being kind of subjective. And then being with Ali the entire time on that journey to the stage culminates really with a wide shot of that stage so you could see what she's seeing.
So that it's always from her perspective, yeah. Not from the audience looking at her.
Yeah.
You are shooting two actors, Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. Bradley Cooper is new to playing music on camera, but he's not new to acting on camera. Lady Gaga is used to playing music, but not acting on camera. So they know a lot about what their abilities are and what does or does not work for them as performers. What are they saying to you about what they feel is right for their performances, and how many conversations are you having with them about their comfort level and about things that they know a lot about that they want to make sure you're capturing with your camera?
They both know a lot about a lot of things. They're very savvy, both of them, in camera position, camera height, focal length. They both know about the quality of light, and they know where the light position is. It's puts a lot of pressure on a guy, you know. the one thing about it, and you hit it, and I think about this all the time, when you make reference to somebody who's an actor playing a musician, opposite of a musician playing an actor, you know, what you have is two people who are helping each other. And the way I looked at it, because they are so savvy in what my craft is, it was almost like everybody was sort of multitasking and sort of pitching in at an equal level about where the right place for the camera was. And I would, you know, make sure that Steph would feel like she was being protected from a light standpoint and a camera angle standpoint, and time again, creating a consistency for her so she didn't have to worry about it. And she could just lean into her performance and lean into the music and just stay connected with Bradley and respond. Because I think often acting isn't just about delivering the dialogue. It's about how you're hearing the other person's dialogue. And the success of a performance, sometimes when I watch it, is it's actually those quiet moments when they're looking and reacting that sets one actor apart from another.
We're talking with Matthew Labatique, the cinematographer of A Star Is Born. People who know your work would say, as eclectic as it is, not always a lot of romance and love.
I work with Darren Aronofsky.
Okay, so a lot of bad things happen to a lot of people, and yet this is ultimately a love story, I want to play a little bit of a scene shot in the parking lot of a grocery store very close to KPCC. Let's listen to this scene.
Tell me something, boy. Aren't you tired trying to fill that void?
Is that me?
That's you.
You just write that now?
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
That scene is the two characters basically alone in a parking lot. Could you talk about how you set up the shots in that scene? What was important and what it means in terms of your style of photography that you had to do a little bit differently to make sure that you were capturing this part of the romance in their lives?
Bradley and I were somehow very connected about the love story of the movie. One of our first conversations was determining that this movie is not about music. You know, it's not really about rock and roll. It's about that feeling you get when you fall in love with someone. And it's about that love story that happens after that. And it's about the end of one, you know. It just had to feel intimate within this odd setting. You know, it's like pulling off to the side of the road, sitting in a parking lot in your car, or sitting on a parking space, in this case, after an evening, you know, of drinking and talking and then having to deal with a broken hand and then ending up in a place that, you know, you didn't plan it, but the evening takes you somewhere. And that was the conceit and the feeling of that. And, you know, the location itself was something cinematic. If a grocery store can possibly be cinematic, it's this one.
Grocery store parking lot.
Yeah, and I credit Karen Murphy, our production designer. She's, you know, they often don't get enough credit with films that are largely on location. And if you look at the movie, and this location is one of them, it really sets the tone of the film. And but that location and that scene, geniusly, it was the tease of the song Shallow.
Right. People probably know what Bradley Cooper looks like, but for the few people who know what Matthew Levitique looks like, is there a cameo of you in Star Is Born?
I was, you know, it's funny. Going into the sort of concept of everybody sort of wearing multiple hats and multitasking, you know, I'm working with an actor who's directing and acting and evaluating performance while he's in a shot. Then I'm working with one of the great musicians of our time, and she's acting for the first time. And at night, both of them are recording music for things we're doing in the future, next week and the week after. So when Bradley said, you know, somebody asked, well, who's going to play the photographer? I asked, okay, who's the photographer? You are. What? You know, and then I look at the lines, and then there's like two lines. And I could, for the life of me, I couldn't remember them. And he just let me sort of, because I'm not an actor, he just let me just sort of improvise. And it was kind of exciting. I mean, even there's a shot of me leaning in after she's told that she's getting a Grammy. And she's really emotional, but I don't know why I walked into and then whispered something into her ear. Maybe I'm naturally a camera hog, but chewing up the scenery, but I don't know. I just did it.
Matthew Levitique is a cinematographer. He has two movies out now, A Star Is Born and Venom. Matthew, thanks for coming in. Great to see you.
Thank you.
I'm alone in my house.
It was a good weekend for Levitique. Both his films, A Star Is Born and Venom, were hits, and they're in theaters now. Coming up, Cat Power deconstructs the song Woman from her new album. And now a new episode from Song Exploder. That's the podcast by our friend Hrishikesh Hirway, in which he sits down with musicians and has them deconstruct one of their songs. Today, it's Sean Marshall, a singer-songwriter who's been making records under the name Cat Power since 1995. Last week, she released her 10th album, Wanderer. It includes this song, Woman, which has Lana Del Rey on backing vocals. In this episode, Marshall breaks down the song and what it means to her as she tells the story of how she made Woman in Miami and Los Angeles over the course of a few years.
My name is Sean Marshall. The reason I wrote this song is because I couldn't find the words to describe how I was feeling inside, very alone. I wasn't feeling empowered or strong as a woman. The beginnings of writing it was just a few of these guitar chords that I've been strumming in my alone time. And then I began singing.
If I had a dime for every time you tell me I'm not what you need. If I had a quarter, I would pull it together and I would take it to the bank and then leave. Yes, I would take it to the bank and then leave.
The beginning lyric where it says, if I had a dime for every time you tell me I'm not what you need, I would take it to the bank and leave, is because I would have been a billionaire with all the different times this had been in my ears that I wasn't good enough or whatever. And that was the beginning, was this just lament. And that's where it was for a long time. I'm also a new single mom. And once you have a kid, all the stuff that maybe made you sad before doesn't make you sad anymore. When you have a kid, it's like, oh, I'm much stronger than I was before, and I don't have time for any of that beepity beep beep, you know? And I think that made it easier for me to meditate on what else I'd like to say. And so through a lot of time passing, that little lament became the skeleton. I started adding more collarbone and then a leg. And it started to grow. When it came time to flesh out the song Woman, I had very clear sounds already in my brain that I tried to find. I love the Rhodes sound. The lament to me sounds questioning, doesn't sound resolved at all. The Rhodes, just the intonation, the notes, it sounds like it's moving forward in a way of like one foot in front of the other, like the beginning of the new journey. I wrote the song because I needed strength and I needed empowerment and I needed to do it myself.
Your cage is like a weapon, a tool for me. You think I'm like the other ones. Well, my cage is a weapon, it's perfect for me. It's the one suit you seem to never see.
Your cage is like a weapon is the social projection on women. There's a lot of social pressure to be the standard, live up to the standard in so many ways. I've always been a tomboy since I'm a little girl, so that's the one suit you never see, the tomboy clothing. And I think it's really important for anyone who wants to go against norms to do so. As I began to record more for the song, more instrumentation, background vocal, it was becoming what it became, an homage for, to, about, with women in general around the world.
Woman, 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 woman.
But it needed some divine feminine transcendence, which as a tomboy, I don't have sonically with my voice, the way that I sing. So besides my own voice, the backing vocals are Lana Del Rey.
Woman, 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 woman.
I met Lana years ago at a hotel pool, and she was such a sweetheart, genuine sweetheart, and that always stayed with me. Because of the loss that I was going through is that needing a buddy, that kind of nod that she's with me. That's why I asked her to sing on my song.
I'm a woman on my word, not having you heard. My word's the only thing I ever needed. I'm a woman of my word, now you have heard. My word's the only thing I truly need.
being able to write the song allowed me to acknowledge my strength and acknowledge my individual sense of truth in my character as a woman. And I don't know if this song would help, but I hope that it makes someone who needs to feel better feel a little better. That's all.
That was Cat Power talking about the song Woman from her new album, Wanderer. You can hear a longer version of that session at songexploder.net. And that's our show for today. Remember, you can find many of our stories at LAist.com. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back here tomorrow.
If I had a quarter, I would pull it together.